One was this example where I took alpha was minus y dx over x squared plus y squared plus x dy over x squared plus y squared, and that's d of the arctan of y over x. And that was given as an example of a form that is closed but not exact. And the reason is the following. It's locally exact by Poincaré's lemma. This is on r minus the origin. So we have a plane that is r minus the origin, and it's very easy to see that d of this gives this. But the problem is that function is not well defined everywhere. In particular, it is not single valued if you go all the way around the plane along the xy axis. So this was the point as to why this is closed but not exact. In other words, d alpha is zero, but alpha does not equal d beta everywhere. And that was the point of this example. And the reason why it isn't, you might say, well, look at it. It's exact. But it isn't because it's not a single-valued function, single-valued on r minus the origin. And I can't remember if I mentioned that yesterday or not. But if I didn't, I'm here to repair that oversight. So this is why you need to define the function everywhere it's okay everywhere on r minus r plus. It is okay everywhere on the plane if you subtract off the real axis. You can see this by going to polar coordinates, for example. If you write y is r sine theta and x is r cos theta, then this becomes the d of theta, but theta is not single valued as you go all the way around. So what you can do is you can define it there, and then you can ask, is there any other form for which this holds that is exact? And the answer is no. Anything that will work will be the same as this up to a constant. And so what you can do is you can get alpha is d beta here. And then if you wanted to, you could do r minus and get a different function and match them in the overlap. But it's not equal to d of a function everywhere. It's only d of a function in one patch, and it'll be d of a different function in another patch. That was the function of that example, and it may not have been clear. So where we were last time, so that was just to say why that is. R2. My apologies. R2 minus R plus, yes. So the way we solve Poincaré lemma in general, so the solution, or the way we solve it, the general form of the Poincaré lemma, the solution to d alpha equals zero is to define some quantity x of lambda little x that equals x mu for lambda equals one, and some other point y mu for lambda equals zero. And we can define alpha of x to be the integral of delta alpha delta lambda of capital X integrated over lambda from zero to one. This will equal alpha at x of 1x minus alpha x of 0x. And you can choose this to vanish if you want it to, if you want to do so. this is just a constant form as far as its dependence on X goes. So you can show in the point, you can show that delta alpha delta lambda is equal to P plus 1 times delta X tau delta lambda times alpha tau nu 1 to nu P of dx nu 1 to dx nu P. And that's not too difficult to, it's not too difficult to demonstrate. Yeah. It could be a partial derivative. No, I'm just doing it. I guess if I used d alpha d lambda, I didn't want that confused with the star d star operator. That's the only reason for that. But it's the partial of alpha with respect to lambda. So you might think that's not obvious, but basically it follows because remember alpha itself is alpha nu 1 to nu p of dx nu 1 wedge dx, or I don't use the wedges anymore, dx nu p. So if I take the lambda derivative of that, I'll get the lambda derivative of this, and I'll get the lambda derivative of each of these. The lambda derivatives of each of these give you this, and the lambda derivative on that is basically the x derivative times delta x delta tau. And because alpha obeys this condition, then the whole thing factors into a total derivative. And I have this tau, I should really write it like that, nu 1 to nu p, comma tau. That means the tau derivative of that, of those alpha components. So therefore, d alpha equals 0 implies that alpha is equal to d beta locally, where beta is this thing in brackets. So that's the p minus 1 form that alpha is the d of. It's the p form on some region contractible to 0. So for gauge fields, what we will do is we will set A sub lambda, maybe A of lambda I'll define as A of x of lambda x, and I will call that lambda A, which is lambda A mu dx mu. So in other words, I'm going to choose this to be so simple that the parameterization just multiplies the gauge field by a parameter lambda. So when lambda's 0, I have no gauge field. When lambda's 1, I have the, or no p form. When lambda is 1, then I have the original p form, or in this case, the original gauge field or 1 form. So then I have, so I'm going to call this A sub lambda, because I don't want to keep writing brackets with lambda. But keep in mind, this is not a space-time index the way these other things are. Is that okay? So F sub lambda will be defined as what we would expect it to be, A lambda squared. And this is just equal to lambda times dA plus lambda capital A squared, where I'll set this to 1, and I'll restore it at the end of the calculation. So now there are some other manipulations that in the interests of time, I'll tell you the input and the output, and then let you work them through. But they really are a matter of straightforward calculus, delta F lambda delta lambda turns out to be twice the derivative, or twice the d of the trace of delta A delta lambda times F lambda. And it's a few lines to show that this is true. It basically, my apologies, this is... the trace of F lambda squared. That's a bit better. Yeah.
I'm having trouble seeing how alpha is d beta. So how we define that beta has p plus one indices, and then also it's p plus one form, and then p plus two form with cd, and alpha is only has a p form.
I've got just a sec. That's because I copied my indices down wrong. That's a P plus one. And what happens is that this index here, I get a tau derivative on the P plus one, which disappears, but that actually becomes a tau. And that's because I copied a line down wrong. And if I put that right with the signs, what I had was correct before. That's because my eye skipped a line. So what happens is alpha is a p plus 1 form. You're right to point this out. Alpha is a p plus 1 form, so it has p plus 1 indices. When I take its variation, I get the or derivative of lambda. I get lambda derivatives of here. There are p plus 1 of them, which gives me this factor. I get a lambda derivative of this thing, but because of this condition, you can show when you fold it in, it gives you zero. So then you can pull back the D to act on the entire structure, and that's what you get. So one of these indices ends up contracting with that, and the remaining P indices contract with that, and that's why beta is a P form. So my apologies, I accidentally copied a line down wrong and didn't notice it. Let's get this all. Here. Where was I? So if you take the lambda derivative of the trace of F squared, you end up with this. And that basically follows because you'll get df d lambda f plus f d lambda df. And then you can take df d lambda by taking the lambda derivative of that, and you'll get a dA, and you'll get a 2a squared. And when you put in all the traces and use the Bianchi identity, you will get this. So to show this, you need the Bianchi identity. But if you fold that in, that's how that follows. I won't do that here in the interests of time. So if I get the integral of, if I calculate the integral of the lambda derivative of the trace of F lambda quantity squared, and I integrate over lambda from 0 to 1, well, that's equal to the integral of... from 0 to 1 of d lambda of twice the trace. If I just expand this whole thing out, I get lambda a plus lambda, sorry, of dA plus lambda a squared. Because delta a delta lambda is just a, and f lambda is just this structure, and I have, yes, so F lambda is this whole thing, and delta A lambda is that. So now we can actually just do this integral. It's easy to do. It's just the trace of ADA plus 2/3 a squared. And that is the expression for the trace of FF dual by this relationship right here. If alpha is the trace of F squared, it's just a fundamental theorem of calculus expression, and that is equal to D of star of J5. So we get D of star of J5 is equal to this construct that I believe I mentioned a couple of classes ago. Yes. Yes, it's F lambda wedge F lambda. F lambda squared. F lambda squared means literally F lambda wedge F lambda. Yes. Because the trace of this F squared is FF dual. I'm running out of room to write it. I guess I'll do it here. F squared, by definition, is F wedge F, which is the same as F mu nu, F dual mu nu, or what I mean by FF dual. I suppose what I should really put here is F mu nu, F dual mu nu, if you want to see indices. But so you're right, they're not forms, but yeah. There is a factor of A that I did not properly copy. Yes. Sorry. Thank you. So when you integrate this, you get a half. When you integrate this, you get a third. So 2 times a half, 2 times a third, and that's how you get it. And this is the structure that came from the diagrams when they were worked out for the abelian anomaly in the context of non-abelian gauge fields. And the nice thing about this formula is that it easily generalizes to any dimensionality. So if you have if you're in 2n dimensions, then the analogous formula is this one here. So you could imagine the gauge theory to be in any dimensionality, and that will be the d mu j mu of 2n plus 1, which in form language will be star of d of star j of 2n plus 1. It'll be I to the n over 4 pi to the n with an n factorial times the trace of f to the n. And this works out to be, if you apply logic of that type, it will be n times d of the integral from 0 to 1 d lambda, lambda to the n minus 1 times the symmetrace of A and dA plus lambda A squared to the n minus 1. It's called a symmetrace, and I'll define it in a minute. Not a supertrace, a symmetrace. That's what people call it. It means symmetric trace. The symmetrized trace. So the symmetrace of TA1 to TAN is defined as 1 over n factorial times the normal trace of the t's where every index is symmetrized. So that's what the symmetrace means. And in, for example, if n equals 3, the symmetrace of TA, TB, TC is 1 over 3 factorial times the trace of TA, TB, TC, where everybody is symmetrized. And that, you can show, works out to be 1 half the trace of TA with the anticommutator of TB and TC, which is the thing we got when we did the diagrams for this particular case here. This case here is proportional to the trace of TA, TB, TC. That was done a couple of classes ago. Times, of course, other stuff, but the gauge part is like that. So if lambda, let's see, if lambda A is equal to some kind of gauge theory that is a form, let's say, how do I want to write this down? If lambda is alpha A TA, then the symmetrace of a bunch of lambdas, let's say lambda I is equal to, I have a bunch of forms, yes?
Is that a commutator?
Which is what a commutator, where? This is an anti-commutator. This. No, this means that I symmetrize over all these possibilities. If it were identical and I had an N, it wouldn't matter. But I could just write it like that. This is just to, it's the reason why I put a comma in is I don't want you to interpret this as multiplication. This means A times the N minus 1 plus this A N minus 2 plus squared A, N minus 3, and all the way down the line. That's the reason for the comma, but it does not mean a commutator. If I meant a commutator, I would have brackets inside the symmetries. So if you don't like that, let me do it this way. Maybe that's clearer. Right? These are round brackets. But this A means I'm symmetrizing over the product of this with N, with this to the N minus 1, which really means I'm doing that. Does that help? Okay. So that's partly what I was going to do here. The symmetrace of lambda 1 to lambda n, or lambda k, it doesn't matter how many, is really just alpha 1 wedge, I'll put in the wedges here, up to alpha n, a1, a2, or k, sorry, to ak, times the symmetrace of TA1 to TAK. So when I symmetrace over a bunch of forms, I'm really doing that, and that's what would go on here. I could factor out the form parts from the gauge parts, and the form parts would be A, wedge this, wedge this, wedge this, wedge this, but then I'd have the symmetrace of the T's for each of them. So the point is the abelian anomaly is given by a total divergence, or it is the D of this thing. The divergence of the abelian anomaly is given by a total divergence in any even number of dimensions. For example, the trace of F cubed, if you work this out, turns out to be D of the trace of A dA squared plus 3 halves a cubed dA plus 3 fifths a to the fifth. Using Poincaré's lemma. And you can write out what this would be with indices. I guess I might as well. Epsilon mu 1 to mu 6, the trace of F mu 1, mu 2 to mu 5, mu 6 is equal to epsilon, or rather is equal to d mu of epsilon nu alpha beta, well that's the screen, sigma tau times the trace of a nu d alpha a beta d sigma a tau plus 3 halves a nu a alpha a beta d sigma a tau plus 3 fifths times a nu, a alpha, a beta, a sigma, a tau. So by in the old-fashioned brute force index language, that's what you would get. So the Poincaré lemma, using this trick, makes it really easy to get this in any dimensionality you want. So that's the power of this approach of doing it. Whereas this is rather tedious to get from the diagrams. Very tedious, in fact. So remember, each one of these A's, A mu is equal to A mu A times the generator, right? So that's why this doesn't vanish, is because they've got this is a T, this is a T, this is a T. Okay, so if I may continue, in the non-abelian case, there is an analogous kind of thing you can do, and it turns out it will give you a rather, it'll give a rather interesting relationship between these cases. If I have a gauge transformation, A goes to A sub G, which is equal to G inverse AG plus G inverse DG, and that is equal to A minus DV if I work infinitesimally and write G is E to the minus V, which is 1 minus V approximately. So that's the group element. This is the V is the algebra element. DV, by definition, is ordinary D of V plus the commutator of A with V. And F goes to FG, which is just G inverse F times G, which is minus the commutator of F with the algebra element. If I do it that way. Now, the point is the following. The trace of f to the n is the same as the trace of f to the n when I transform it. That should be clear. Each f gets a g inverse g on either side, and they all crush into each other, and the maybe I'll call this prime. So the trace of F prime is just the trace of F. Or I guess I put G's, the prime's redundant. So if I do that, it's the same thing. But the point is that this, this quantity that has disappeared on me, this quantity that I guess is underneath this board. I'm going to call this quantity, assuming I can rub this out. I'm going to call this quantity here omega 2n minus 1, 0. And I'm going to put the n inside. Well, I don't need that bracket. So this whole quantity I'm going to call omega 2n minus 1. Omega naught 2n minus 1. That quantity is not gauge invariant. So how do we see that? Well, I have to have 0 is the gauge variation of trace of f to the n, because the trace doesn't change at all. So under a gauge transformation, this is exactly the same as this. They're equal. So if I make an infinitesimal gauge transformation, I don't get anything happening. Well, that's the gauge variation of d of omega of 2n minus 1 as a function of a. I didn't put the function of a, but obviously that depends on a. And that will equal the differential of the variation of this quantity. Yeah.
Should there be a D on the right hand side?
Should there be a D where?
The D star J5 is trace of.
Yes, there should be. Sorry about that. I was saying that equaled that, and then I just didn't want to rewrite the equation, but yes, you're right. So, so zero is D of this variation. But that means that variation locally itself, by Poincaré's lemma, is the d of something. So this thing here tells me that the gauge variation of the anomaly term is itself, at least locally, the total derivative, or an exact form, of some other thing that depends on both A and on the gauge parameter. Locally, of course. So in other words, the anomaly is not gauge invariant. It's rather gauge variant up to an exact form. So how are we going to figure out what that is? Well, delta V of f lambda is going to be minus f lambda on v, but we'll also get another term that is the anti-commutator of that. That follows from the definition of f lambda as written up there. Unless lambda is 1, unless lambda is 1, you do not have this transformation. And if you work out infinitesimally what A does, I won't do it here, but you actually end up getting this. Clearly, when lambda equals 1, we recover the old result. But when lambda is not 1, it's not doing a simple gauge transformation. It's actually got this extra stuff. Okay? So, if you shove this into here, I don't like suppressing steps, but I think I will. What you end up getting is this is equal to minus n times the integral from 0 to 1 d lambda times d acting on the symmetrace of this gauge parameter with f. So this means vf to the n minus 1 plus fvf to the n minus 2, et cetera, et cetera, plus n minus 1 lambda minus 1 times the symmetrace of, now I've got three different things. This is indeed a commutator. And it means I'm symmetrizing over three kinds of things in all possible ways. So there's curly brackets way out there. And this last term what am I going to call these terms? This last term here is equal, after a lengthy calculation that I can let you see the details of, but which I don't want to grind through in front of you here in the interests of time. This last thing is equal to the symmetrace of V with the anticommutator of A with A lambda and F lambda to the N minus 2 plus the symmetrace of V A F lambda to the N minus 2 A lambda, like so. So it is a rather long, not a super long calculation, but if you're asking how do I go from here to there, it's not trivial. There's several lines of arithmetic that what they basically involve is pulling out these pieces. You get a T, a commutator of T's, and another bunch of T's. You break the commutator into two pieces, and one of the pieces is manipulated to give you that, and the other piece manipulates to give you that. And that's what you have to do. So the breaking into two pieces is due to this commutator. And I've got the arithmetic on the sheet here. I've worked it all out if you want to see the details, but I would rather get to the point. DF lambda is equal to F lambda A lambda. So DF lambda to the N minus 2 is just this same commutator. So delta F lambda delta lambda is DA plus A with A lambda. And so that bit of arithmetic here forces this, which equality am I looking at now? So that forces, if you use this in here to get rid of some terms, that forces this equality, which is the symmetrace of V delta F lambda minus dA from that thing in the bottom times F lambda to the N minus 2. And the other one is plus the symmetrace of V A and D F lambda N minus 2. Let me put brackets, it's not a commutator. So that's another intermediate stage in this somewhat laborious arithmetical exercise, but where you end up with that, the object of the game is to figure out what that omega 2n minus 2 structure is. And so it's going to equal, remember, the D is here, so that D pulls out. So this whole thing is going to be that omega, let me just write it in. It's omega 2n minus 2, 1, just to remind you what that was. So that stuff, this term here is that thing. The first term comes into play as well. And when you put this together with that, let me just write out the result. It is not a priori obvious. It's n times n minus 1 times the integral of d lambda of lambda minus 1 times the symmetrace of v, with D acting on the symmetrization of A with F to the N minus 2. So it actually compresses down after some arithmetic to that form. So let me just write out what it looks like for N equals 3. For N equals 3, we have omega 1, 4. 6 minus 2 is 4. It'll be 3 times 2, 3 times 2, times the integral from 0 to 1 d lambda, lambda take away 1, times the symmetrace of v and d of a, times, since that's just one factor, it's just this times this, lambda dA plus lambda squared a squared. And now all of these integrals can be done. You get 3 times 2 over minus 6 times the symmetrace of v of dA, d of a dA plus 1 half a cubed. And that is the non-abelian anomaly that we looked at, I guess, at the beginning of the week. So in other words, the reason why I pushed through this is I wanted to get to that. Oh, I keep thinking we have to stop at 4. It's actually 4:15. So maybe that's a bit too fast. I have suppressed arithmetical steps to go from here to there to there. Obviously, you're not going to see that. I've written down the main points, but if you want to work through it, it's a bit of work, but it's not terrible, horrible work. And I can let Dan and Tibra, well, I believe they have a copy, and I'm happy to let you guys see this to work through the arithmetic. But it is just arithmetic with gauge covariant derivatives and symmetraces and so on that get you to this point. So what is the point? The point is that the gauge variation of the abelian anomaly is the D of the non-abelian anomaly. So this is the relationship between the two. If you have an abelian anomaly in a gauge theory, suppose you have a gauge theory and you look at its chiral transformations, a massless gauge theory, you look at its chiral transformations, you will in general get an abelian anomaly if you're in an even number of dimensions. The gauge variation of that anomaly is the D of the non-abelian anomaly in two fewer dimensions. Delta of omega 2n minus 1 is the D of omega of 2n minus 2. And the exponent 0 means there's no dependence on a gauge parameter. The exponent 1 means there's a linear dependence on the gauge parameter, which is that thing right there. Yeah. This means what I said earlier, A comma F lambda to the n minus 2 is a shorthand way of writing A F lambda to the n minus 2 plus F lambda A F lambda to the n minus 3 and so on. You just shuffle them around so it's fully symmetrized. The comma, if I did this, you would think it was a product, but it's not a product. It means you have to symmetrize over all that junk. It's D of the symmetrization of that thing. This is the symmetrace. Yeah. So let me summarize what the main points of this rather semi-tedious mathematical exercise is, because this implies there is a connection between all the kinds of anomalies in gauge theories as you jump from even dimension to even dimension. They're all interconnected with each other. And so a summary is that the abelian anomaly goes like trace of f to the n, which is d of omega 0 2n minus 1 of a, and that's because d of this trace is 0. So Poincaré's lemma tells us locally this is true. Delta v of omega 2n minus 1 on A is the D of omega 1 of 2n minus 2 of VA, where we can write this out, which is the D of the non-abelian anomaly. So the gauge variation of this form is the D of the non-abelian anomaly, and the abelian anomaly is the D of this form. This is called a Chern-Simons form. Chern-Simons form. So the gauge variation of the Chern-Simons form is locally the D of a non-abelian anomaly in one less dimension or of one less form value. What else can I say in the remaining time? So any questions up to this point? Not that you're reticent about asking. So there's another viewpoint that I think I can sketch out in the remaining time. If you take the effective action of a gauge theory of massless fermions, then if there is an anomaly, the covariant divergence of this variation will not vanish. This is the current, and the covariant divergence of that will not vanish. So let's define operators that are this with that. In other words, it's d mu with the variation of A. So this thing acts on functionals of A, first taking the functional derivative of A and then taking the covariant divergence of the answer. You can show that these things obey a Lie algebra. So an anomaly, sorry, yeah? They'll be the same as the group that, yes, of the, whatever the non-abelian group that A's are the gauge fields of. Yeah. So the anomaly is that equation. In fact, I don't want to waste valuable board space. So under this way of looking at it, an anomaly is basically XA, of course, these depend on X, acting on gamma of A is going to be something non-zero, so let's call it G. And it will be a functional of the gauge fields. So this isn't, so far, any big deal. It's just saying this covariant divergence isn't zero. Let's call it something, and let's call that something G. But now the commutators of these X's imply that XA commuted with GB of A is equal to F ABC GC of A delta of X minus Y if that depends on X and that depends on Y. Because it's a functional variation at A of X, this will give this thing will be zero everywhere unless y equals x, in which case we get a delta function. And this relationship is equivalent to saying delta u of g of va, which I'll define in a minute, minus delta v acting on G of UA is equal to G of the commutator of UV with A. So what the heck do these things mean? Delta U is the integral of over X of UA XA. So I take this operator. Remember, this is a function of the space-time point, so I integrate over space-time, and that's delta u, or delta v. And g of ua is defined to be the integral over x of ua ga of a of x. So if you integrate both sides, integrate over x times ua and over y times va, this relationship turns into that relationship. And so one can then ask, what is it that solves these equations? In other words, one can say this is what you get when you have an anomaly, and then one can ask what are the possible solutions to these equations. Maybe I should back up. It's not quite the anomaly yet. So what would be a solution? So let's take this, call it star. I think I'll just go here to rub off less since I've only got about five. So if I just look at it from a functional integral viewpoint, I have this functional G, and if there is an anomaly, then these X's can act on G like so and can give me a set of equations. So I can ask, yes. V comma A delta V U comma A.
So is that the argument? Or?
Yeah, that's the functional argument where this thing here is that thing there and so defined. So it's like you've smeared out G over some gauge parameters and smeared out X over some other gauge parameters in space-time. That's basically what this is. The idea of this operation is to smear out over the delta function. So I've integrated times some gauge parameter over space-time for x, and likewise over g as well. So the question we can ask is, what are the solutions to star? Remember, g is a signature, there is an anomaly. If there's an anomaly, g will be zero. So one solution is g of va, say, is delta v on g hat of a. In other words, maybe this g is a gauge variation of some local functional. Then you'll get delta u delta v minus delta v delta u on that local functional, and it will just tell you that the commutator of delta u and delta v is just g of those commutators, or g of the commutator of u and v. What is a local functional? It means the same as an action. It's the integral. Everything is at the same point instead of at two different points where you smear over it. But this is not, let's see, it's not the most general solution. Some solutions to that star equation way over there are not gauge variations. If there exists a solution that is not delta v of some g hat, then we have an anomaly. Then we have a bona fide anomaly. The star relations are called the Wessimino consistency conditions, or just often just the Wessimino conditions, sorry. So one such solution is that g of va is equal to the integral over some manifold of dx to n of this omega 1 thing, of this non-abelian anomaly structure. And you can show, which I won't do here, but I'm happy to let people see the arithmetic unless they make you do it as a homework, that delta u of this thing minus delta v of the same thing with u and v switched is indeed equal to g of this commutator of a. Where g now, maybe I should call this g tilde because it's a solution. So in other words, one solution is the variation of some local functional. Another solution is this thing. This is not the variation of a local functional. This is a local functional, but it's not the variation of something. So if you do the variation of this and subtract it with u and v, you can show via, in my view, about four lines of manipulation that you get a commutator in here, or rather a commutator in there. And so the non-abelian anomaly obeys the Wessimino consistency conditions. And in fact, non-abelian anomalies are basically the non-trivial solutions to the Wessimino conditions. They have to, how are we doing here? They have to obey them. So I think I will stop here since we did a lot today, and I know I suppressed a lot of arithmetic, but that is basically what we've done here is showing the topological structure and the connection between the abelian and the non-abelian anomalies, and then pointed out in this last 10 minutes that non-abelian anomalies are the non-trivial solutions to this equation. So they are there. And all of this stuff is standard in gauge theory, but it emerged, we have residuals of this all the time. Chern-Simons gravity theories, Chern-Simons gauge theories, string theory introduces these kinds of terms from various dimensions according to the conditions you want to have, and so on. And this is where they were, this is their root. Yes, and then here. Pardon me? To my knowledge, yes, I think so. It's either variations of something or that. So this is kind of reminiscent of the cohomology problem, and there is a gauge cohomology thing, right? We want all the solutions to that kind of equation that are not themselves variations. So this is not the gauge variation of something. Yeah, I guess you, okay, yeah.
Doesn't the abelian anomaly also have to satisfy this? So how do we
get the abelian anomaly is odd. Remember, there's a 2n minus 1 for the abelian. It doesn't work the same way. That matters a lot. So the variation of abelian is d of the non-abelian, but the integral of non-abelian is the solution to that thing, basically. Or if you like, the non-abelian is the solution to that thing, but that's not the same as the abelian. It's a subtle distinction that can indeed get confusing. A bit like memorizing all the different string theories. Yes?
So, this is a bit abstract. Is there a way of kind of, you know, connecting all the different, like, do these things connect different gauge theories in some way? Or?
Well, they do in some way, yeah. And you can, a Chern-Simons gauge theory arose by saying, okay, for a normal gauge theory, we get this anomaly, but now let's forget about where it came from and just construct a gauge theory made out of it and see what it does. And it turns out it has rather interesting properties. In part, those properties are connected with these topological things that when you look at the functional integral, you find there's quantization of certain parameters due to these topological properties. So yeah, 2 plus 1 gravity is a kind of Chern-Simons gauge theory, and there are higher dimensional versions of all those gravity theories that I think Olea and other people, Olea and collaborators worked out, the South American group, I forget, Transco maybe. But basically there are certain particular choices of nonlinear gravity theories that are higher dimensional Chern-Simons gauge theories, and their properties are not really a whole lot studied at this point in history. So yeah, the answer is yes. When these were first explored, people didn't understand what they were good for at the time. And then when string theory came along, they had lots of uses in there. People used them for that. But that didn't take too long. This was all about roughly at the same time of the 1984 string revolution, a little bit before that. Okay? So tomorrow, 9 a.m., the time room.